Margaret Lee Nam's interview of her brother Jonah, R.E., the Pineapple Factory in Wahiawa, on July the 28th, 1994.
Okay, Jonah, why don't you tell me about the CPC, which is a California Packing Corporation, from your earliest memory.
My earliest memory is CPC, California Packing Corporation, located at the end of Kane Street, facing towards the Wild West side of the town. As I recall, my father used to work in what kind of work he did in the carrier, I really don't know. All I knew, he was working in the carrier as a worker there. And he lived in one of the plantation homes provided by them. And this simple plantation home was constructed lumber, owned by 12 lumber. It's a simple construction home. They have a running water there, a kerosene stove, and an old-fashioned ice box. It was covered by ice, block of ice. And as far as the water there, the water was supplied by Wahiawa Water Company. It was a privately owned water company at that period. The water we got there wasn't a really pure water at all. Sometimes some mosses come through the water pipe. So subsequently, our parents, they smoke bull durum, which comes in a bag. We take the bull durum bag when it's empty, and we use it as a water filter. My mother used it as a water filter, tie it over the water pipe, so it is filled to catch all the moss that comes out of the water. Those days, as far as sanitation concerned, we believe the water was purified somewhere with chlorine probably. But we don't have to boil the water at all, so we can drink it directly from the faucet, with the exception of this, once in a while this moss comes out. And as I recall there, it was a small little home, two bedroom home, kerosene stove. And all the things you buy there, I think the company used to own a store there. Right?
Where was the company store? Do you remember?
Somewhere around the camp area.
Uh-huh.
It's more like a camp, right? Camp. People get paid and buy from this company store. So what it all amounts to is, like the coal miners in Kentucky, all the mines is, you work for this company, they pay you, you turn around, you buy their products, they get the money back. They just one revolving going around. So as far as these people are saving money and making money, it's quite rare they can save money. Because those days, I believe he was paid about $1 a day. I believe, if I recall, they gave you a kerosene allowance of a gallon a week or something. Free kerosene. All he had is a kerosene stove. And as I see, you buy from the company store. They pay your salary, you buy from the company store. The money revolves around back to the company.
Mm-hmm. Can you remember and tell me about how many people were working and how many people were living in that CPC camp?
I don't. It's quite a big camp there. The camp was right close by to the cannery. As far as I recall, there's over 50 homes there. The homes are all similar type. All the same type of construction. They look the same alike. Everything is alike. In a small little yard there.
Uh-huh.
And all the people working for the cannery. That's about much I can recall.
But that wasn't Union Camp, was it?
No, that's not Union Camp.
Now, where was the CPC camp exactly? I can't remember where the CPC camp was.
It's currently somewhere around where the Wahiawa police station is right now.
Oh, okay.
Somewhere around that vicinity.
Uh-huh.
And you have, right next to the police station, you have some housing area. You have a low-cost housing. It's around that vicinity, around that area.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
That's where the cannery used to be, and that's where the CPC camp used to be.
So that across the street where the Civic Center was, we used to be all the Lunas then. You know, all the pretty homes there with all the beautiful trees? Were there all the CPC Lunas who used to live there?
I don't know if it was all the Lunas on this. We were more like a foreman's or who I've called Lunas. I don't know if all lived there or not. I have no idea.
But
they had nice big homes. The plantation Lunas and plantation supervisors, they had nice homes.
Mm-hmm. How did your parents manage to raise you in small homes like that?
Well, those days, although the wages were small, food was small. In those days, you can buy a 100-pound bag of rice for $5. You can buy a tofu for 5 cents. Today, it's over $1.50. Today, a 100-pound bag of rice probably costs you about $30 or $40 or $50, somewhere around there. But those days, you can buy a 100-pound bag for $5, and for 100-pound bags, you can feed a family four or five.
Mm-hmm,
mm-hmm. Everything was cheap. Meat, those days, if I recall, you can buy hamburger meat for 15 cents a pound. You can buy bread for 5 cents a loaf. And soup bone, you go to the butcher's market, they give you the soup bone. The free, eh? Meat you can buy for about 15 cents a pound. And they used to have restaurants there, they run the restaurants there.
Uh-huh. There
used to be a railroad station there, we had a railroad depot. And the restaurants there, run by, normally by Japanese people, you can have a simple stew and rice for 10 cents, with all the ketchup you want.
Then you used to go to the theater over there?
Yes, they used to have a Victory Theater there. right now it's located by this restaurant, Sunnyside. And they call it the Victory Theater. And those days, it cost about 5 cents to go to a movie.
And what did you see?
It was a silent movie, a Tom Mix, Buck Jones, those kind of types of movies, cowboy movies. For 5 cents, you can watch the movies. It'd be a bathhouse, there's two bathhouses in Waihawa. One was located Palm Street. One was located right next to the Victory Theater. And it cost you 5 cents to take a bath. It was Japanese type food, what they called it. In those days, a lot of these homes, there's no such thing as a water heater. So all the bath you can take is go to a community bathroom for 5 cents to take a bath. And it was really convenient for the whole community, because nobody could afford the luxury of a heater. In those days, no such thing as... well, they had water heaters, they had an electric stove, but it's very, very few of those items. And only the rich could afford it.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And I say most of the people use kerosene stove, and ice box for refrigerating, real ice, block of ice. Every morning, Waihawa town used to have an ice mill, which they manufacture ice, and they deliver the ice to each homes. But I think it costs 50 cents a month. They bring an ice, some homes they bring it every other day, or some every day, they bring a block of ice, about 25 pounds of ice. You use the ice in the wooden ice box, and that is your refrigeration, keep the food fresh. Milk, those days, it's a Waihawa dairy. Used to deliver milk by the bottles, the quart bottles. And you tell the delivery man how much you want, how many quarts you want, one or two, and every morning he leaves the amount of quart you want. Like my household, we have 2 quarts a day.
2 quarts a day?
2 quarts
a day. At your CBC house?
No, this was after we moved out of the CBC house.
Okay.
It's far later, years later,
okay.
We moved this away from CBC. But you see, after a couple of years, the CBC County closed down, and they moved to Iwale, to the present site. The factor was transportation cost. In those days, the transportation from Waihawa to Honolulu takes you several hours to get there. It was winding roads and old dirt roads, and it was a long drive. And transportation was very expensive.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, those days we had a train system, but no such thing as trucking system at that period. But the train system was very expensive. So for cheaper for the pineapple company to open up a new cannery close to the port. So it opened up at Iwale, was close to the port. So they can manufacture the candy pineapple and they can ship it to the mainland. It was
mm-hmm.
cheaper than haul it all the way from Waihawa and store it in Honolulu and then ship it.
Mm-hmm. Then what did your daddy do after
that? After that, that period, I kind of quite lost it, but I think, if I recall, the Schofield Barracks came up. That's where they had a lot of soldiers there. So subsequently, someone has to do their laundry.
Mm-hmm.
So what they did, they invited, I think, civilians to come in there and do their laundry.
Mm-hmm.
My father went in there as a London. He did the landing for this unit called 8th Artillery. They are all different units there, but he happened to do the landing for 8th Artillery. And he started out as a landing recruit system. And that's how he earned his living.
Mm.
Then later on, what they did is, when they established the barracks there, they gave them a space so they can have the shops, their laundry shops. And of course, they will do all the washings and ironing outside of the post, and they bring it in, yeah, to the post. And after, 2 years later, when they got the space there, they do all the ironing in the post, do the washing outside, do the ironing in the post, and they give the clothes out.
Mm-hmm.
And that's how he made his living. And later on, in addition to the laundry, he had a small minor tailor shop, which he did minor type of sewing, repair work, sewing. So he became a tailor shop and a laundry shop. He did that for quite a number of years until 1941, when the war broke out. That's when all the civilians had to get out of the post. In the meantime, during that period, post laundry came into play. Prior to the war, they had post laundry. Their post laundry did so much of the laundry for the military people. Of course, they cannot absorb all the business because it was too vast of military. I think they had about one or two divisions there.
Mm-hmm.
It was too vast for them to take care of everything. But the post laundry, which kind of work laundry they do, is they take care of all of their socks, underwear, and underclothing, and so forth. Some of the clothing too. Bulk of the civilians who had laundry scattered around the post, they take care of all their trousers and their shirts, you know, and hats. They had hats, mm-hmm. those type of clothing, not their underwear.
So when World War II came, by that time, you were getting onto a young man. What did you do?
Well, when World War II broke out, prior to World War II, I after graduation from Little High School in 37, I'll tell you, a lot of these people come from a family. We have four or five kids, six, seven kids. Some of them were rich, some of them were poor. Most of them us couldn't afford to go to college. So what we had to do was go find a job. Job was scarce those days. The only job you can find mostly is a post exchange. So after school, I worked for the post exchange a couple of years. No, during my high school years, as the senior year, I worked in post exchange, joined someone to go to college. But fate played a hand part there. When I was ready to go to college, I had $350 saved. And those days, tuition was about $50 a year. I could have well afforded a work part-time job. That was my plan. However, my father got into a debt, a serious debt. Of course, my mother passed away when I was 15 years old. So he was a bachelor. He was in serious debt. Well, one day he came to school and he begged me for that money. Being my father, I couldn't refuse him. So I gave him all that money. He says he'll support me to school. He paid his debt. Then, after he paid his debt, he was service motor. At that time, there was a car. Eh? The service motor says, I wanted the legal papers for the car, for the car's repair. He says, no, he says, my father still owed the money. I said, what money? He told me, he owed money for washing machine. So I got teed off. So I kept on working at night and school during the day. I paid off his washing machine debt. Of course, by the time I finished school, I had no money to go to college. So what I did is, he couldn't support me, so what I did is, I worked there at night, and then I saved some money, and I went to Honolulu Business College.
Oh!
That's one school I could afford. It cost me about $10 a month. Of course, those days we had a group of us was going to business school in town, Cannons and Honolulu Business College. So we shared a car ride. This guy had a car, so off. Cost was $3 a month. However, since being not enough money to live on, a lot of times no such thing as lunch.
Yeah.
After 6 months of that, see, I couldn't take it.
Oh.
So I quit school and went back to work full time.
Where did you work?
I worked for postage chain.
Oh.
It was 19 infantry there at that time, they called it.
Mm-hmm.
I worked there. Then in 1940, I believe, I got a job with the USED at the time, they called it.
United States Engineering Depot.
Division.
Division, uh-huh.
I worked for that for a while.
What did you do?
I did there as a clerk of work. And then in 41, when the war broke out, I still worked for them, and in January of 42, I got married.
Ah!
I got married, and my wife and I, she worked for the government, I worked for the government, so both of them worked me. Then in 41, I believe, I got drafted. But however, going to basic physical, they found out I was so underweight, I was rejected.
You were rejected.
Because underweight.
Because you were underweight.
Yeah, the standard was you have to be 105 pounds. You know.
And how much did you weigh?
I was weighed only 90 pounds. So 4 years later, by 1940, I believe in 44, I think they had the draft again. Eh? So when the second time when they had the draft, I got drafted again. Eh? And this time I weighed about 120 pounds. So I got drafted in the first draft they had, and I got into the service. I stayed in the service for 2 years.
What branch was it?
I was
Army, Navy, Marine?
It was the Army branch.
Uh-huh.
Army, I stayed in the Army there 2 years. And
where did you go for basic training?
Basic training, what do you call it? 13 Replacement Depot in Wahawa. Prior to finish my basic training, just because I was a Korean, they wanted Korean interpreters. However, I cannot speak the language well. And just because I'm Korean, they took me out of the basic training, they sent me to Hilo without my knowledge. They sent me to Hilo because they had a Korean prisoners of war in the KMC, Korean Kilauea Military Camp. 104 Korean.
104 Korean prisoners of war.
And they had over 2,000 Korean prisoners of war at the Sand Island in Honolulu.
2,000 Korean prisoners of war who spoke Korean and were laborers of the Japanese?
They were laborers of the Japanese. They were captured in Taiwan, Tinian, Saipan, all those islands brought over here as prisoners of war. Although they were construction workers, they classified them as prisoner of war because Korea was under Japanese rule.
Uh-huh.
From there, they sent me to Hilo to be an interpreter. By golly, I was shocked because I cannot speak the language well. So, however, I had one Korean boy, they spoke a little broken English. So, between he and I, we got along very well. And in the meantime, I learned quite a bit of Korean from them, and he learned English from me. So we managed to communicate to each other.
Mm-hmm.
And stayed there, KMC, for about a year. And then they shipped me down to Hilo. They had about 50 Koreans down there, two prisoner of war, in Hilo, working at the docks. And there I stayed there about 6 months. Then when the war was over, they shipped all the Koreans back to, at this time, they relocated all the Koreans from Sand Island to prisoner of war camp right across Schofield, Willowfield Gate, in that vicinity, right across Willowfield Gate in Wahawa area. Right now, they have a Schofield water plant right there, right in the back of the water plant, that's where the camp was. And they had all the Koreans prisoners of war there, and we all were relocated there. It was formerly an Italian prisoner of war camp. They were all relocated there. And after, I believe, 6 months, somewhere in December of 46, I think, they sent the Koreans all back to Korea.
Did you go with them?
Yes. And we whole bunch of us, about 21 of us interpreters, Korean interpreters, we boarded the ship with these prisoners of war and took us all back to Korea. Mm-hmm. From Korea, we landed Incheon Harbor in Korea. There, we set them all free. They were on their own after that.
Mm-hmm.
And us military people, located some of us in Seoul, some of us in Incheon, some of us in Busan. Nikki Sean and I were located at Busan. And it was very fortunate to have my grandparents, my aunties and uncles living there. See? So it was a nice assignment for them.
Mm-hmm.
And we stayed there, and after 3 months, we started discharging the graffitis. I was one of the first to be recalled for discharge. And from there, they shipped me to Japan, Camp Zama. We stayed there 30 days waiting for a shipment to ship us back to Hawaii. Finally, after 30 days, there was a boat coming back to Hawaii. So we boarded the boat, came back to Hawaii, went back to 13 replacement depot, got our discharge papers there. And after 2 months of taking life easy, decided to go back to work. I went back to my old civil service job. And
which there, was at the post exchange?
No, at that time I was working for USCD.
Oh, okay.
Then from there, I worked for them for a couple of years, then I transferred to the Air Force. I stayed with the Air Force for about 35 years. And I retired in 1980. After 37 years of service, I retired.
Mm-hmm. When you were looking over the Korean prisoners of war, what were their concerns? Did they have any concerns? So did they have any primary things that they were worried about?
Well, one thing they were concerned about is why were they classified prisoners of war? Because they had to carry the big sign PW on the clothing. To them, they were construction workers, they were civilians. And they say they are not prisoners of war, they were just civilian workers and captured. Of course, they were working for the Japanese army and doing construction work. However, the United States claims that Korea was underneath Japanese rule, so they were Japanese citizens. Although they were construction workers as a civilian, since they were Japanese citizens, they were classified as prisoners of war.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
But that technically, that's what I've been told. But whether it's technically just true or not, I don't know. So I have to accept what they have been told.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So that's the big gripe that the Koreans prisoner of war have.
Now, Jonah, are you the one that went back to Korea and you saw someone who recognized you, they said, "Are you the son of so and so?" Because your sister had mentioned that.
When we took the Koreans prisoner of war back to Korea and was assigned to Busan, first thing I did is trying to look up my grandparents. My mother used to visit Korea quite a lot, so I had the address of my grandparents, but not knowing where the location is. At the state railway station, I happened to come across a Korean lad. He spoke little English, but he understood where I wanted to go. I showed him the address. So he took me with him and to my grandma's house. As we were walking down the street, here this lady was walking, coming down from the street. I was walking up, she was coming down. One look at her, I knew who she was, and one look at me, she knew who I was, because she looked exactly like my uncle, perfect image of my uncle. So right away, I stopped this lady, I asked her, "Are you Mr. Suk Jun Lee's sister?" He said, "Yes," he said, "that's my brother." And then we hugged each other, and I told her who I was the son. She looked exactly like my uncle, couldn't miss. I never seen her in my life, she never saw me. Then from there she turned around and both of us went back to my grandma's house. That's where I met my grandma. Then, of course, my mother died in Korea and she was buried there. So what I did is, I made arrangement, trying to make arrangement with the Red Cross to have a body exhumed and shipped back to Hawaii. But the Red Cross tells me they have nothing to do with it. You see the chaplain. I saw the chaplain, told him my problem. The chaplain says they have nothing to do, go see the Red Cross. So I got disgusted and fed up. Each one passing the buck. Each one don't want to help me. So finally, I went to the... In the meantime, my uncle, he already exhumed the grave. He put all the bones in the box, neatly packed, neatly wrapped up. So I took that box to the postmaster, the post office, the Army post office, and I told him the story, what happened. And he tells me, see, you know, it's illegal to ship the bones back to as a postal matter. See? So however, he says, in such a unique situation, he'll cover up and he'll do it for me. So he shipped it as a goods or something else. And of course, I paid a postal fee, whatever it cost. It was about $20. And he had a ship, I had a ship back to Hawaii to kill David, my brother David. When he was got the package, he was so surprised. So he took the package to Boston, a mortuary in Honolulu. There, my sister had a small plot in Honolulu. Oahu Cemetery, we had him buried there. Then, many years later, when my father died, my sister, okay, had it exhumed and put the bones, so still in the steel casket, in my father's casket. We buried them both together.
Together? Yeah. Oh, that's lovely. That's lovely. Yeah. How did you feel? I understand that your relatives took you up to a place in the room when they opened the trunk and they showed you your mother's remaining clothes or things. Did they do that?
No, I cannot recall.
Must have been some another thing.
Let me see, I want to tell you about. You know, when this was a prisoner war with his Korean prisoners, I learned many tales and stories about it. Recently, when you hear in the newspaper about a comfort woman.
Oh, yes.
I heard that from the Koreans way back in 1946 when they were captured. They told me that in all these islands where they work, and they have Japanese soldiers there, they had these comfort women in there. And you see what they did? They were giving the chits. I think they were allowed one chit a week, which they use for a woman. Eh?
Not the prisoners of war, Korean men too?
Yeah, they worked with them. Plus the military soldiers, they all were given these chits. I think these chits they allowed, and I think the 4 chits a month, they were allowed sexual intercourse with these women, eh? They once a week. Eh? They were given these chits. And that's where I heard about this. So when I heard about this comfort woman in the paper lately, it just made me laugh to think about this was happening way back in 46. I heard about it. He was telling me about it and all about it. So it was nothing new to me.
Almost 50 years later and then it comes out.
It comes out.
Did they ever tell you stories about atrocities?
Well, yes. You see, lots of these Korean prisoners, construction workers and for the Japanese people, lots of them, they say, lots of the bodies committed suicide. They jump over the cliff, they die. I said, why did they do that? They says, well, you see, the Japanese government showed them film of atrocity, American atrocity. But I'm sure the film's all touched up. It shows where the steamroller rolling over human bodies while they're alive. It showed them the cutting of their arms and all that kind of torture. So rather than be captured and be tortured, they rather kill themselves. So lots of them committed suicide.
Oh.
It was very sad. So lots of them during that fighting period, lots of them were just, they're going to die anyway, but lots of them were so thirsty for water. You see, they want to drink of water before they die. So lots of them have themselves captured. But when they were captured, they were shocked to find out that Americans were humane people. They treat them good. They fed them well. They gave them all the Medicare. Medication, the water, and the food, and what they were sick, they couldn't believe it. So then they realized that the Japanese, all the propaganda of atrocity was all false. So they were happy that they were didn't commit suicide, you were captured.
Were they kind and were they courteous to you and all of the other interpreters?
The Korean.
Yeah.
They were very kind. Prisoners. They were very kind. They were very courteous, and they were very good workers. But you see, the problem I have with them is the Koreans are rice eaters. In military, no such thing as ration for rice. It's strictly potatoes. So subsequently, I had a difficult job getting these potatoes, finding other military kitchen like the Navy, the Coast Guard. I go over there and swap the potatoes for rice, if they have any rice. Normally they give them a bag of rice, just for rice pudding or whatever they make, or other things used for rice. But, so I get all the rice I can. I'll swap it for the potatoes, and so then they have rice. And Koreans, they gotta have their rice 3 times a day. They have rice for breakfast, rice for lunch, and rice for supper. If they don't have rice, they refuse to work. One time the rice went out, they refused to work. They're all going to sit on strike. After talking to them, I guarantee they'll get some rice. They all went back to work.
Well, tell me about the kimchi and the chili pepper.
The problem is this. They know how to make kimchi. Actually, the Koreans are not good cooks. They construct labors. The problem with making kimchi is you got to have garlic, which they didn't have garlic. You got to have chili pepper, which they didn't have chili pepper. And as far as cabbage, well, they can get head cabbage. The military gave them a sack of head cabbage as a vegetable staples. So what they do, they take the head cabbage and make kimchi out of it. But I go to Hillertown. Whenever I go to Hillertown, I buy them all the garlic, and I buy them all the chili pepper, and buy them sugar with my own
money.
With my own money. The army don't issue them
that's
garlic
right,
or chili pepper.
That's right.
I buy them with my own money. And from that, they make their own kimchi. And some rascals there, somehow, some of them work at the KP in the kitchen, in the army mess halls. What do you some of them? They swipe some yeast.
Oh!
They swipe some yeast.
Make beer or wine, rice wine.
And they do make beer or wine out of from the yeast.
Smart.
Somehow they get sugar.
Yeah.
Because they get some sugar and they get their own massage. They get sugars from the sugar from the yeast. They make their own liquor, wine or beer, whatever they call it, Korean. Korean liquor. Once in a while, the military go to the camp for search. But this is a big lab. They come out with gallons and gallons of wine or okoli, or whatever I call it. It's just a lab. But they cannot stop me. They repeat this thing over and over again. But it was a fun thing.
Yeah.
But that's how the Koreans got their chili pepper. Some of them, ingenuity, what they do, they take the seeds of the chili pepper, and they plant, make their own seedling, and they plant their own chili pepper. And what shocked me is, when I buy them garlic, the way they ate the garlic, they gave each one a clove of garlic. The 104 of them, each one had a clove of garlic. And by golly, they eat the clove of garlic just like eating regular food. They chew it down. I was shocked when I see that. As long as I live in Hawaii, I didn't see nobody chewing a whole clove of garlic.
They had to have the garlic.
They had to get garlic. Of course, they use that in cooking kimchi, but they eat the garlic raw.
Mm-hmm.
So it was a surprise. And in those days, of course, the food there was cheap. The pay wasn't that cheap. It cost me quite a bit of money to buy that on my own property.
That was your humanitarian effort.
Well, it really was. But I couldn't help but buy that for them.
Mm-hmm.
After all, they just cannot survive with garlic.
You understand.
Kimchi, understand.
Yeah.
And they show you which they get allowance, which is not enough for them. Mm-hmm. Basically, all the food they cook, we show you. Mm-hmm. They like to buy them, show you. No money. But they were happy, and I was happy helping them.
What about the Japanese prisoners? Did they have Japanese and take care of them from Hawaii?
As far as I know, we had no Japanese prisoners or no Japanese interpreters at all.
I see.
I don't think we had any Japanese prisoners. Uh-huh. Not in Hawaii.
Uh-huh.
As far as a lot of these Koreans speaks Japanese very fluently.
Uh-huh.
Although they speak Japanese fluently, we never had a Japanese listening interpreter. Because the Koreans just object to it.
Uh-huh. Uh-huh.
But Koreans, as a Korean intelligence, is fine. Not a Japanese listening interpreter.
So that's probably one of the more memorable times in your life, taking care of the Korean prisoners. Actually, I just recently heard about it. I didn't realize that there were Korean prisoners of war conscripted by the Japanese to become laborers and then brought here until recently.
Mm-hmm.
So it must have been sort of quiet then, no? Or did everybody know
that period back before this terrible season,
mm-hmm.
everybody knew they were prisoners, especially while I was here.
Mm-hmm.
It was right up at Wheeler Field, close to Iowa Town.
Yeah.
And this local Korean ministers from Methodist Church, Christian Church, used to come over with the Sunday services, preach to these Koreans.
We have Reverend Lin.
Reverend Ahn, coming there and give Sunday services, perform Sunday services. In Hilo, there was Reverend Chung. He come over there. They were twice a month, come over there to give a Sunday service to the Koreans.
That's good. That's very, very enlightening information. I just think that's something that not everyone in the world knows. With regard to you and your family, you were born here in Waihewa?
Yes, I was born and raised in Waihewa all my life.
And you've lived here all of your life, right here? Yeah.
Except for my
time that you went
in
to
the service.
Uh-huh.
All my life.
Mm-hmm. The transitions and all of the changes, one of the things that somehow has changed is the pineapple industry.
Yes.
And
sugar cane
industry too, which will greatly affect Waihewa's water once Wailua shuts down, Waipahu shuts down, you're going to have problems, I guess, with the water here. Is that true?
No. I don't think we'll have problems with the water because the Waihewa water was taken over by Water Honolulu water supply many years ago.
Uh-huh.
Once upon a time, way back in the 20s, 27th, 28th, and it was owned privately, but now it's taken over by Honolulu water supply.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And it's the water. We have abundance of water in Waihewa and we get a lot of rain.
Mm-hmm.
See, at one time the water used to come from the mountains in the reservoir well called Waihewa Heights. We still have the reservoir up there. But recently, in the past 10, 15 years, I believe, we dug a well and the water comes from this well now.
Mm-hmm. It's an artesian well?
I believe it's an artesian well.
Did you have to work in the fields, pineapple fields, when you were young?
Well, when I was young, practically just about every youngster in Waihewa, they know. Sometimes they work in the pineapple field. That was the only jobs they had, work in the pineapple field or work in the cane field. People from Wailua normally work in the cane field. Waihewa people work in the pineapple field.
And tell me about your days, how you went to work.
Well, we live in Waihewa at home with our parents. Of course, my mother rises early in the morning, prepare lunch, which consists of an old-fashioned lunch pail with rice and other kind of goodies inside there, which can last during the day, which doesn't spoil. Right? And pack my lunch for me and my brother David, and we go to Waihewa Town. There's a meeting place in Waihewa Town, spot. I think it was close to a CPC camp. There, it can take us by truck to out in the pineapple fields, in the Halemano area, right? Wailua area, and walk out there, the pineapple field. We start work about 5 o'clock and get through about 3 o'clock in the afternoon. And the way we were paid is, those days what we do is, after they pick the pineapple, what we do, we cut the top off, and trim the top and trim the bottom of the pineapple and stack it in a box. And you put about 8 pineapple in a box in the crate. And someone, after there, where you mark the crates, eh, someone come along and identify your name and how much crates you have. And what they did is pay us 1 cent a crate. For 1 cent. That's the way it paid. And what they did is, after they mark it and it's recorded, someone recorded, that crate is shipped into a flatbed truck. And the flatbed truck take it to the railroad station close by. And from there, from the railroad platform, they load it all on the train. After they have, what, 25, 30, 40 cars, haul the thing all the way to Iwale Plantation at Honolulu.
That was every day?
Every day.
Every day, 25 cars.
That was during the summertime.
Summertime, because that's peak season.
That was normally June, July, August.
Uh-huh. So how much did you earn a day?
Well, earn a day, sometimes we earn about $1 a day.
Dollar a day, 100 crates.
Normally, it gave us 1 cent a crate. Eh?
Uh-huh.
When we went picking pineapple, they had pineapple tops. It comes in huge pile. They keep them out in the field, certain area, too close to the camp. What we do is, on the bottom of the pineapple, we tear off some leaves there. So we leave some core there. Mm-hmm. And the leaves, they take that is the one they use to replant. Eh?
Not the leaves, but the core.
The core with the leaves. In other words, the pineapple tops.
That's what they call the slips.
Yeah.
The slips.
Not the slips, the pineapple tops. Slips is from the side of the plant which they take inside of the plant. The cake is, in other words, coming out.
That's
called the slips. This is pineapple tops. We know what type of the pineapple.
Yeah, I know what it looks like.
That we clean the end. And I think we used to be paid about... I think we used to pay for every 100. We paid 1 cent for every 100.
My goodness. What did they do with the tops?
That's the top they take to plant.
To replant.
Replant for next crop.
For the next crop.
It takes about 18 months for a pineapple from the time it's planted to the time to harvest. It takes 18 months to harvest a pineapple.
Mm-hmm. What did you do with your money? Did you have to help your parents?
With that money, that's a good question. With that money, we normally... our parents use it to buy us clothes to go to school. Because those days when you go to school, there's no such thing as shoes. Of course, they buy us clothes like pants, shirts, school supplies. That's what they use for. And, as far as I recall, no one wore shoes when they were going to school. The only time that I wore shoes was when I started going 7th grade in high school. Of course, we had shoes, but the shoes was on special occasions, you know, parties or church or something like that. We never did wear shoes to go to school.
Uh-huh.
Always barefooted.
Mm-hmm. What are some of your fond memories? For instance, what did you do for recreation, or what did you do to get into trouble?
My fond memories, when we were youngsters, about ages, I say, about 12 or 14, we do a lot of swimming in the river.
In the river?
That's where all of us go down there, swimming in the river. That's where we learn how to swim, and that's where we enjoyed our swimming.
What part of the river was it?
They call it Old Train Bridge, just a big train bridge going over towards Wailua way. It's a very high, tall bridge, and that was the swimming hole for us.
Now my question is, did you ever jump off the train tracks into the water?
Yes, from the third highest level. It's over 100 feet. And what we used to do, no such thing as swimming trunks. So what we used to do, when you come down, the force is so great, the water run up your nose and hurt your nose. So what we do is the guava leaves. What we do, we bite the guava leaves between our teeth, and we jump down. As we jump down, the leaf goes up and cover your nose so the water pressure won't go in your nose. That was our way of protecting our nose.
But what about your ears?
Our ears?
No bother.
No bother at all.
Was there a lot of fish in the river in those days too?
In those days we used to go fishing too, a lot of time. But they had bass. what they call bass.
Bass.
We used to catch bass, and the way we fished in other discarded pineapple field, old pineapple, we used to have one of these grass that grows tall, and it's more like a branch. It grows tall. We break that off, maybe the thing about 5 feet or 4 feet, whatever it is. Mm-hmm. At home, of course, a lot of parents get number 10 threads. You take the number 10, some of the number 10 thread, you tie it to this branch, pole, is a fishing pole, and you buy hooks. You can buy those days, you can buy hooks for maybe for 5 or 6 for a penny. We use that thing, and then we use for earthworms. They all were coming in, except for the earthworms, or in the valley, or the gulch, or moist area, and that's how we go fishing. But all the fish you catch there, depends on what size. Some of it is 3 inches, 4 inches. Some people take it home and eat it. A lot of people took that home and eat it. Like me and my brothers, we don't. We just catch it for the sport of it. Whoever want to take it home, or if not, we just let it go. The bass normally are about 3 or 4 inches. To us, it's considered small.
Too small.
But
do you ever catch a big catfish? Because I've seen catfish down there.
We caught catfish when the water recedes and the water got really low. It's more like a stream only. There's a lot of catfish. You go there, catch catfish with the hook of one. And you catch catfish, you catch quite a big size. It's about 7, 8 inches catfish. But those, we don't eat it too. We just for the sport of it, because whoever wanted can take it home.
Yeah.
But we never did eat fish.
We never ate fish from
the river. Never did.
Why? Your parents wouldn't let you have it, or you just felt it wasn't good?
No, we just felt it. I tasted it once. Tastes
muddy,
and it didn't taste good, so ever since then we never did eat it.
Very, very interesting.
In those days, the water was really clean.
Yeah.
Everything was clean. The water was pure, clean. So we swam in there, fish in there. Today it's all polluted.
All green, yeah. So, if you wanted to go to the beach, how did you used to go to the beach?
As far as going to the beach, those days people were poor, family were poor. Owning a car was just about to be a millionaire. But fortunately, my father, business, calls for a car. So he knew how to learn how to drive, and he had a Model T, he had a car. However, most of us didn't have a car. The only way we go down the beach is walk. Bunch of us from Waihawa, we walk all the way to Haleiwa Beach.
Oh my God.
We did swimming there and we walked back home.
So that was a whole day.
And those days at the Waialua Haleiwa Beach, the army used to bring down the troops there by truckloads and swarm the beach area. But since then, the beach used to be a beautiful beach, but today it's all changed.
From erosion?
Erosions, and storms, rains. Uh-huh. It's changed. Those days the sand used to be clean, white.
Yeah.
Clean, beautiful beach. The area used to be very clean. Mm-hmm. That's when we go do lots of our swimming over there.
Mm-hmm.
And if we're lucky, we can hitch a ride home, but very rare we catch a ride, because those days cars was a luxury.
Yeah.
But all our swimming in salt water, strictly walking for all those miles.
Yeah. One of the things I ask everybody is this, Jonah. What event or events made a very strong impact upon you, so much so that it made a turning point in your life? Do you know what that was?
The only thing I can think of.
Take your time.
I don't know about the turning point. I think the one that greatest event is the passing of my mother. We were youngsters then. I was only 15 years old. I was just a sophomore in high school. And David, my oldest one in our family, he was just a junior then. The youngest one was Songsan. He was about 3 years old. I think that was the greatest impact in my life, the passing of my mother. Being young as I was, I had to take over the household, do all the household chores, I had to do all the cooking, and I had to look after my brothers and sisters. I think that was one of the turning events in my life.
Do you think that that kind of value about family closeness is something that drew you all together very, very closely?
That's one of the reasons why I think we are very close as a family. We are very close. But I think because of the fact that we have no more than an early age.
Mm-hmm.
And my father being a philanderer,
mm-hmm.
so we were much of our own, eh?
Mm-hmm.
And we grew up together. We could look after each other, so that's why we're very close to the area.
Mm-hmm. Tell me what you felt when you saw when you knew about bringing your mother's body. I mean, bones to Hawaii. Tell me what your insides felt like. Tell me what it felt like to be in Korea and to have done this. It surely must have felt something. Tell me what you felt like at that time.
Well, that's one of the first things I did when I was in Korea as a GI, after I saw my grandparents. I asked where my mother's grave was. So they took me up this hill. By golly, that's the first time I seen Korean graveyard. I was so shocked. It was on a hill. And all the graves, all the big mounds. I think, what are these mounds doing? So I found out that that's the custom Korean burying. They did. It's all big mounds.
One after another.
It's some sight to see. Like America had underground and headstone, but this is all the hillside with big mounds, earth mounds. So that's how they buried. That's the way they buried the dead. And of course, it was a sad occasion for me to visit my mother's grave. And of course, I always planned that if I was going to Korea, I was trying to be go back to Hawaii, which I did. I was very happy on that one. Now that both of them are together, that really made me happy. It made the whole family happy to see our parents, at least some occasions like Memorial Day, Christmas, or New Year's, where someplace we can go and visit our parents. Whereas if she was still in Korea, we had nothing to visit, to reflect our memories of our mother.
Mm-hmm.
That made me happy.
Jonah, believe it or not, we're all first Koreans born in America.
Yeah, first Korean.
What do you feel as an individual you will leave as either a legacy, or how would you like to be remembered?
Well, this actually, being the state as I am, I'm not a man of wealth, or I'm not a man of means, or I'm not a man of literature, a man of stature, or a man of just known throughout the community or throughout the world. I'm just a simple man. All I want to leave behind is what I can do today. And what I'm doing today is I do a lot of church work. I'm trying to do as much as I can from doing church work, such as taking care of that church building, taking care of its ground, taking care of other needs as much as I can.
Mm-hmm.
And I want to leave this world as people know me as a simple man. Not a man with means or a man with fortune or a man with fame or nothing. It's nice. But just a simple man. And that's the only legacy I can leave. As far as my children, I leave them. What I can leave them is my home. That's the only thing I can leave them. It's the only thing I own.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm sure they have a good education. I want them to have a good education. That's the best legacy I can give my children, a good education. And of course, this property I have, it's the only thing I own and the only thing I have and the only thing they can get. And that's the only thing I have. And just when people know that's just a simple man doing the simple things.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the thing I want to leave behind. So people want to say, yeah, Mr. Lee, I got to take care of a church, you know.
Mm-hmm.
He's all right. It's good enough for me.
I think that's a wonderful way to be a Mr. Lee. That is a true. Isn't Mr. Lee a form of the name Yi?
Yi.
Yeah, of the dynasty Yi.
Yeah. Actually, what happened is when our parents came over here, when they go to immigration, they ask the name, say Yi. You know, they mean Ri, yeah? Yi. So this, of course, is Howlis, or the white race of Howlis. See. All the thing is Ri, oh, Lee, L-E-E.
Ah, so your name was Ri, R-H.
Ri, actually, Korean is actually, all the Lees in Korean actually is Ri.
I see.
Since you see Ri, so they took it as Lee, so they put down as Lee, so therefore we became known as Lee.
Ah,
truly, I think we are Ri.
So
you know how difficult it is if you're a Howley man and I'm a Korean, Howley can speak English, I say, it's your name, I say, Ri, Ri, you will say, oh, Lee. That's how he got the name Lee.
I understand. Do you have anything that you'd like the world to know about yourself?
No, not really.
Okay. This will conclude the interview with Jonah Lee, who lives in Waihewa, Hawaii.